I don't think you can have an economy that isn't grounded in public law. And as a result of that, I don't think you can have a money that serves the functions that the public monetary system does today that isn't grounded in public law. And because a lot of these private actors don't see that, they start from the wrong foundation, and they end up not getting to where they think they're going to get.
You are listening to Money on the Left, the official podcast of the Modern Money Network Humanities Division, or MMNHD. In this episode, we're joined by Rowan Gray, president of the Modern Money Network, director of the National Jobs for All Network, research fellow at the Global Institute for Sustainable Prosperity, and JSD student at Cornell Law School. Rowan also works as a consultant to the International Telecommunication Union's Working Group on Digital Currency, and as an advisor to eCurrency Mint. In these and other capacities, Rowan has spent a lot of time thinking about the past, present, and future of money as a creature of law. Our conversation with Rowan covers a bit of the recent past, but the majority of the episode is dedicated to Rowan's current work on the political, economic, and cultural implications of money's digital future. It's a vital conversation that we can't wait to share with you. Thanks, as always, to Alex Williams for producing this episode and to Hillbilly Motorbike for providing us with the theme music.
All right, so Rowan, you've obviously got multiple irons in the fire, but today we've invited you to speak with us about digital money and specifically why it matters for the left. To get the ball rolling, can you sketch a picture of the current state of digital money for our listeners? What types of technologies are out there? Who are the major players in this world? What kinds of arguments they are making about the future? And what is politically, economically, or even culturally at stake? In other words, why should the future of digital money be a central concern for leftist praxis?
Yeah, sure. So the first thing to note is there have been proposals for digital private money going back decades. I think maybe David Chalm in the early 1980s was arguably one of the first to put together a sort of technical proposal. There was a burst of energy around the idea in the early 1990s when the internet was first, becoming big in a mainstream sense. It fizzled out for various reasons, some technical, some political, some just based on decisions people made. It was revitalized after the 2008 crisis, in part because of the crisis, and in part because of a white paper by a pseudonymous author called Satoshi Nakamoto, who wrote a paper about this blockchain technology that was supposed to solve a technical issue in cryptography called the Byzantine Generals Problem, about how to sort of maintain a consensus between non-trusting entities about a common ledger or a common set of data. That paper led to Bitcoin and a surge of interest from technologists, investors, bankers, anarchists, and members of the public and media. So you had this sort of software revolution. At the same time, you had this hardware revolution in the global south of all places, in places like Kenya, because of the rise of cell phones, where suddenly you don't need a single bank or banking system to process all the transactions in the community. You could have every person essentially communicate with each other over the cell phone network and their phones to do the job of sort of managing ledgers and processing. If you had a distributed mobile phone technology in the 1700s, perhaps you wouldn't have seen the rise of private banks at all to do that kind of centralized or intermediary transaction processing. But because a lot of those countries in the global south didn't have a particularly developed banking system, these mobile money technologies were able to sort of fill the gap to an extent. So you had a kind of hardware and software revolution going on in different places. And people started to sort of take seriously the idea that sort of digital money's time has come. A lot of people, of course, were just driven by profit motives and dollar signs in their eyes. And unfortunately, often the capitalist movers are the quickest off the bat when it comes to new technology. But, if you think of the existing monetary financial banking landscape as being shaped in part by the material structure and limits of the money technology itself. Coins in one era, paper money in an era, different forms of legal accounting, you know, double entry accounting and things. These technologies of money and finance shape the economic structure of the economy. And, you know, if you think about the way that digital technology worked or communications technology, before we had the internet, we had phones, fax machines, paper, pages, Morse code, you know, cell phones, desktops, etc. And now you have this sort of one general purpose computer in your pocket connected to a general purpose data network. And all of these various functions are all being done, you know, through this single common kind of general infrastructure. You can think of this moment in history as a moment where a sort of thousand different, seemingly distinct monetary and financial processes are collapsing into mere variations of a single digital thing. And that's a sort of pretty transformational moment in terms of technology of money. Unfortunately, a lot of people working in this space have a poor understanding of money as a social, political, legal phenomenon beyond the technical aspects of sort of transactions and payments. You know, they sort of studied orthodox economics, or they sort of, you know, Austrians or whatever it is, libertarians. And as a result, a lot of their energy and attention has been misplaced. You know, it's that saying, if you don't know where you're going, you'll probably end up somewhere else. So they thought that the kind of theory of money was easy, and it was just the theory of the technology that was hard. Whereas in reality, both are hard, and you need to understand kind of both. So you had sort of technologists and cryptologists who think of it as a technical problem. You had anarchists who saw the importance of digital money as a way of sort of preventing the surveillance, the totalitarian kind of control that the internet has a potential for. So if you think about government shutting down banks or things in Egypt or Iran, or, you know, cutting off donations to WikiLeaks and things. And eventually governments and regulators stepped in. First of all, it was just about how you regulate this private activity, you know, how you sort of allow private innovation, blah, 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 how you set up regulatory sandboxes so people can experiment. But over time, and particularly in the last couple of years, there's been a rise of, or a growing appreciation amongst policymakers and central bankers and things, that public digital currency is necessary as well as merely private ones. It went from, this is a nice idea that'll never happen, you know, going back to James Tobin and things decades ago, to, well, this may happen in the future, but it's a long way off, to, this is happening right now, what are we going to do about it? The reason I think this is relevant for leftists to a big degree is that at the moment this conversation is dominated by technocrats, by, you know, capitalists, by technologists who don't have necessarily the best leftist politics, even if they consider themselves progressive. And at the central banking level, these are people with sort of degrees in macroeconomics or modeling, statistics, maths, who are making pronouncements about the future of economic privacy and civil liberties. They're not consulting the ACLU, they're not consulting, you know, the public. They're just making these decisions as a sort of footnote in a paper that's otherwise full of mathematical models. And so you have debates over private currencies, private databases, private transactional platforms. That's your sort of Bitcoin blockchain world. You have debates over sort of anonymous or censorship resistant, or sort of central node resistant technology. That's your sort of crypto community. And then you have people looking at things like central bank digital cash, central bank cryptocurrency, things like that. And that's where my interest is mostly at, because I think that's the kind of where you really need to be thinking about the politics of this in terms of the sort of global public policy implications. And, you know, a lot of the conversation there is over giving people the equivalent of a sort of public bank account. So an account at the central bank or a postal bank or something like that, or a public bank. I'm more interested in trying to create the digital equivalent of cash, because I think it's important to be able to have transactions that can go ahead even without the pre-approval of some central regulator. Once the cash is in existence, like notes in your pocket, you and I can transact with those notes, and the paper notes themselves are not going to call the police. The police can monitor your activity if they have a search warrant or something, or even if they don't. But it's not like that the money itself is sort of spying on you and reporting you to the cops. So I think it's important to have that kind of technology. And I was actually at a conference at the St. Louis Fed a few weeks ago on cryptocurrencies and blockchain. I talked to a well-respected economist there, wrote a paper on privacy and anonymity in money, and he was talking about it in the context of sort of avoiding scam marketers who follow you around after a purchase if they could sort of see you making that purchase. And I said to him, surely the whole kind of totalitarian fascist threat is a bigger issue. And he said, well, yes, but that's too big an issue for economists, because someone can always just make a big argument on the other side. So you have to find something small that people can grasp and start from there, which I found to be kind of illuminating and depressing. So to go to the question about sort of the stakes of the debate or the contour lines of the debate, I think there's a question of how much of this new technology or infrastructure is going to be perceived as a public good or as a private market good. And within the private space, how much it's going to be perceived as the domain of sort of banking and finance, a sort of banking tech versus a financial extension of IT. So sort of whether this is going to be kind of Goldman Sachs and Citibank or it's going to be Apple and Google. And then within the public side, there's a sort of debate about whether this is exclusively just a technical upgrade to existing central banking operations or whether it's part of a broader digitalization of government finances, sort of in the vein of like Estonia's e-government model. And in terms of the technical, as I mentioned a second ago, there's a sort of debate over having accounts with an intermediary versus having what's, you know, legally called a bearer instrument, where you own a sort of digital wallet and any of the files in that wallet belong to you as a bearer. And then, of course, from a leftist point of view, there's the global geopolitical and imperial considerations of these technologies. So you're seeing sort of Russia developing a crypto ruble, Venezuela developing this petro that's tied to the oil reserves in their country, the European Union talking about the need for a new global payment settlement system independent of the US-dominated SWIFT system, because the US is using that control over the payment system to strong-arm other countries into supporting its sanctions on Iran. And, you know, in terms of why leftists in particular should care, in addition to just the political stakes there, I think, firstly, we should never let a crisis go to waste. You know, digital technology is uprooting existing ways of doing things, which is creating new forms of instability. It's changing power relations between different actors, you know, empowering new kinds of workers, new models of organizing. Things that were solid are melting into air. You know, things that were fixed and frozen aren't so much anymore. And at the same time, there are kind of new fracture lines emerging within private capital. Different actors are scrambling for dominance or sort of eating each other to sort of see who's going to be at the top of the new mode of monetary technological production. And you could weaken and exploit those fracture lines, I think, to an extent. And of course, all this is happening against the backdrop of the collapse and reorganization of global finance in the wake of 2008. So if you think about the kind of political moment in 1945 or the political moment in 1971, the way that those decisions there about the shape of international finance sort of shaped global political economic dynamics for decades after, I think we're in a moment like that. And the last point on that is a sort of more abstract idea, but I kind of think of this as like the digitalization of certain kinds of analog politics. And what I mean about that is, if you think about the way that sound production works, there's a difference between analog and digital sound recordings. Analog recordings are, you know, record a smooth curve of different frequencies, where digital recordings have a series of sort of slices of zeros and ones. Now, if you have it at a small enough scale or a big enough scale, those digital sounds can sound very good, and you can make extremely complicated shapes out of them. But there's at the core of that technology, you're moving from a smooth gradient to a zero or one binary. And I think of that in terms of certain political questions today. So the kind of classic historical tension between freedom and privacy on one hand and sort of security and control on the other. For a lot of history, when it comes to money, there's been a sort of unsteady compromise where physical cash can be used to facilitate crime, tax avoidance, child pornography, you know, rings, terrorism, etc. But on the other hand, it allows people to engage in transactions without needing the approval of their local banker or government, etc. And that's been politically valuable. And the way that we've maintained law and order in those situations is we put legal restrictions on top of the money technology. So we've had search warrants, we put tracking devices in wads of cash, we try to monitor serial numbers when they come back to banks, we put limits on undeclared interstate transportation of cash. And at the same time, there were physical limits on cash itself. You know, there's only so many briefcases that you can kind of carry. There's only so many slabs of newly printed notes you can put in a plane hanger. There's only certain things you can buy with cash versus other forms of money today. But if you fast forward to a world where your digital wallet can hold $1 trillion just as easy as it can hold $10, and where all transactions don't distinguish between, you know, cash, debit card, wire transfer, etc. But at the same time, where any security compromise, any backdoor into that wallet of yours means a total security compromise. The minute, you know, you let the NSA in at all, they get to see everything. Suddenly, all of those kind of muddling through tensions, all of those 50% compromises don't really work so well. And you're sort of forced into a sharper dichotomy. Do we let private transactions exist and risk a permanent shift in favor of privacy and against security and control? Or do we eliminate that entirely and have a world where all transactions are sort of under the eye of the panopticon? You know, do we think the NSA and the Chinese Communist Party surveillance is a bigger risk than kiddie porn networks and the Taliban? So, you know, to me, this is a sort of socialism or barbarism moment, technologically speaking. And you know, that's an important kind of moment that we shouldn't let be decided without some left intervention.
So, thinking broadly, systemically, politically, how would you say that your specifically legal MMT intervention really challenges the arguments and paradigms that are out there? So, you know, what are you doing that's challenging the field of digital money as it is? And more importantly, what kinds of collective transformations do you think this makes imaginable?
Yeah, so let me just give a little bit of background as to what I'm actually doing. I started off writing a research paper on mobile money that I got, that then put me in touch with some people at the USAID's mobile money team. They put me in touch with a group of people who are working on a form of central bank digital cash technology, who are also quite involved with the United Nations telecom regulator agency called the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union. And they read my white paper, and when we kind of met, they said, look, we've got the technology that we think works to do, you know, what you're talking about, essentially digital government cash. And, you know, once you have cash, you can create accounts on top. If you imagine a bank with a safety deposit box, you know, you can put cash in the safety deposit box, and as long as that bank can be given permission to take cash out of your safety deposit box and put it in someone else's, then even though the technology is cash, you can create the equivalent of accounts. So the cash technology is the sort of fundamental layer as far as I see it. The bare instrument technology, I should say. But they said to me, we've got the technology and it, you know, we've done successful trials, but when we go to speak to central bankers, ironically, they get the technology, but they're concerned about the economic implications. So they asked me to write a white paper for them on the economic implications of macroeconomic implications of digital fiat currency. And from there, I got more involved with the International Telecommunications Union, and now I'm helping draft their regulatory standards for central bank digital currency or government digital currency around the world. The way I think law is important here is, first of all, I see a lot of MMT analysis as essentially or implicitly legally informed, which is one of the reasons I think I was so drawn to it. Understanding money as a creature of public authority and as something that manifests in legal design, as people like Chris Dizan, who you've had on this podcast earlier, talk about. So thinking about things legally is a good way of getting to the relevant sort of technical layer of the system for me. Second of all, it allows you to cut through a lot of the theoretical bullshit that you see in economics. You point to me to the statute, you know, point to me to the accounting provisions, point to me to the banking charter and the legal rules that limit what that bank can do, etc. So being able to frame things in a kind of in a language that isn't just a subjective economic language, but a language of law that still has ideological content to it and still has the potential for political disagreement, obviously, but it's a different kind of fight than if these conversations are taking place purely in the language of economics. You know, you've got heterodox schools of thought and the orthodox schools, etc., and they can barely speak to each other. Whereas when you go to law school, even if you have people who are extremely different politically, they still kind of can walk into the same courtroom and engage in the same legal processes. And that kind of common language that's tied directly to the kind of empirical reality of how these institutions are working is valuable. The other part of it here is that legal structures can be designed in different ways to achieve similar outcomes. There's a great historian of the common law I forget his name, but he sort of said that the history of the common law is that if one idea doesn't give you the outcome you want, you just use another one. So if contract law doesn't give you the outcome you want, you use property law or tort law or something. And you can create the same phenomenon of, say, a contract through the language of property with slightly different sort of window dressing. And so by being able to separate the sort of form from the substance, but also understanding how important the form is to the substance, it allows you to sort of be pretty creative with the way that you design things and the way that you redesign things to illuminate different aspects of the system or to open up new possibilities and things. So, you know, we're going to do more work on that. I'm interested in sort of helping social movements and things have their ideas be sufficiently granular and legally robust, even as I kind of work on the inside with these policymakers and things. But ultimately, even when I was at the ITU conference that we helped co-organize at Cornell Tech a few months ago, one of the central bankers from Brazil, who is sort of the head of the Bank of International Settlements group on digital money, that works on digital money, the Committee for Market and Payment Infrastructure, CPMI, said, well, I've been working on developing a taxonomy of digital fiat currency, but I'm not a lawyer. It's really great that we finally have a lawyer here who can help with this stuff, because ultimately this is going to be written into law. It's going to be written into policy documents and things. So at the end of the day, the lawyers are going to be called in eventually. We might as well sort of get there pretty quickly.
So your project, as we understand it, is to design a digital fiat currency system that radically restructures finance around public and environmental interests and severely contracts, or in Keynes's words, euthanizes the private rentier banking system. But before we get too deep into those weeds, would you mind giving our listeners a brief introduction to the present structure and perverse workings of the private for-profit banking system?
Yeah, I mean, you know, how much time do you have? So my advisors at Cornell, where I'm doing my legal PhD at the moment, Robert Hockett and Sally Morover, have written a very good piece that kind of goes into this in a fair bit of detail called The Finance Franchise. And essentially their argument there is that the commercial banking system, with all of these chartered banks, when they make loans, they don't just take, you know, the money of people who've deposited money at that bank and lend that money out. You know, sort of, you give me $100, I lend $50 to Billy, blah, blah, blah. It actually, what happens is they extend credit and they get support from the central bank, which in turn is backed by the government, the rest of the government. And in doing so, they're creating new purchasing power and new forms of bank deposits that function with money properties. And so in that sense, they're essentially engaging in a sort of fiscal activity. They're extending the full faith and credit of the government to new forms of investment, new forms of spending, in ways that are, in theory, in accordance with a kind of public purpose or a sort of public-private partnership model. And you have a whole range of macro-prudential regulations about the and micro-prudential regulations about the kinds of loans that banks should be able to issue and the purposes for those loans, etc. Of course, once you go beyond the commercial banking layer, you also have the kind of broader shadow banking or shadow money system, which in part relies on the commercial banking system and in part relies on the ability to use collateral, including government treasury securities or other forms of safe collateral, and turn that collateral into money through legal contractual arrangements called repurchase agreements with either dealers or the central bank. And my friend Daniela Gabor has written a lot on this, on the way that this creates this whole sort of shadow money of system underneath the regular public money and franchised commercial banking system. So both of those sort of layers, what I would call sort of franchise money, which is explicitly channeling the full faith and credit of the government, and these forms of shadow money, which are trying to give the impression through various forms of legal technology and business arrangements that they are as safe as or sort of somehow connected to or backed by public money. You essentially have a world where, as Hyman Minsky said, anyone can create money. The challenge is to get it accepted. And various forms of financial institutions have worked out various ways of getting their money or their liabilities accepted as money more broadly. The last way I think that's useful to think about the existing banking system is that in many ways it serves a social function as a payment system, both at the retail level. You know, you and I do most of our transactions through a bank account, not through cash or not through, you know, any other sort of financial platform. And also at the sort of wholesale level, where you have these large, you know, institutional investors with hundreds of billions of dollars in a pension fund or a hedge fund or something, storing their money in very, very liquid forms of financial assets like treasury securities or money market fund shares that are supposed to function similar to a bank account. And one of the reasons why they don't just use bank accounts is because of the legal limits on deposit insurance. So I have a friend who is in the Treasury Department at Goldman Sachs. They're the people sort of responsible for keeping the cash flow alive at Goldman Sachs. And I said to him, you know, most of the time you're keeping your quote-unquote cash in three-month treasury securities, right? T-bills. He said, yeah, of course. And he said, that's what the money markets do. We keep our money in T-bills. When we talk about cash, we talk about T-bills. And I said, but if you... And you can't keep it in a bank account because you have limits on how safe that money is above, you know, $250,000 cap. He said, yes. And I said, if you didn't have a cap, if there was unlimited deposit insurance, would you need to be doing all this stuff with T-bills? He said, no, we just keep it all in a bank account. So the entire structure of the payment system is also a function of the way that we set up these rules for the banking system. And money, you know, to use that Minsky line, anyone can create money. The challenge is to get it accepted. If money is a credit instrument, then anyone that will accept a credit instrument of someone else as acceptable payment is engaging in a monetary sort of activity. So you need to think of the payments infrastructure and the payments ecology as intrinsically connected to the monetary system, which means intrinsically connected to public finance, but also intrinsically connected to banking.
So then how can a new digital fiat currency transform money creation, finance, banking, and so on?
Yeah, I mean, so the first thing is I don't think that the technology itself necessarily changes the underlying political potential to transform money creation, finance, etc. It was always there. What it does is change the balance of power and change the kind of viability of certain strategies. So firstly, I think it simplifies and clarifies the way that the public financial and banking systems works. Just to give an example about that, you know, right now we finance government deficits by issuing treasury securities, usually into a private market, although places like Canada have had the central bank buy that directly in the past. The private actors buy up these treasury securities with money that central banks have injected into the banking system. And then once those securities are held by those private actors, the central bank then intervenes again to buy up as many of those treasury securities as it feels necessary to make sure that the overall supply of liquid reserves or settlement balances stays roughly the way it was before the whole process began. So even though what looks like governments are quote-unquote borrowing from private actors or private actors are quote-unquote buying government debt, really what's happening is the central bank is monetizing or funding the government deficit indirectly through those private bond auction participants. And as long as those bond auction participants know that they could turn around and sell those treasury securities directly to the central bank the next day or 5 minutes later for a profit, they're always going to stand in the middle of that trade because they get a free profit. So, you know, the creation of digital fiat currency allows us to revisit a conversation of, well, why do we do it like that? Why don't we just allow central governments to issue a currency, you know, a digital version of a platinum coin or something, and finance their deficit directly like that? And if we want to create some other kind of instrument, a new, you know, that functions the way that a treasury security does in the financial markets for collateral purposes or anything else, well, we can do that as well. But we don't have to keep the system the way it is right now. And we can be sort of more clear about what these processes are actually doing today, even if they might have done something very different at the time that they were first instigated. So, of course, you know, if you're under a gold standard or a fixed exchange rate regime, then treasury debt does serve a very different function to cash itself. You know, treasury debt is a claim on cash which is backed by gold, but treasury debt itself isn't backed by gold today. Whereas today, you know, in the modern time, that distinction is largely non-existent. In addition to that, in addition to making the system more simple or more clear, it can also make explicit the underlying political claims or the underlying political kind of dynamics at play. So as I was talking about before, you know, as my advisors Bob and Sally talk about, you know, if you think of banks as franchised entities of the sovereign, then every time a bank extends its own liabilities, creates new bank deposits when they make a loan, what the Bank of England calls fountain pen money, because, you know, the minute you approve a loan with your pen, the money is comes into existence. There's no reason for that instrument to look and function differently than the government money that's been created. There's no reason to have bank deposits and government money be two different kinds of instruments when bank deposits are backed by the government anyway. You know, it's sort of like, why have a private army wear its own uniform when it's serving the sovereign, rather than just putting them in the same uniform that everyone else is wearing, and be very clear about the fact that these actors are engaging under public authority. You know, it's useful if you want to give the impression that Blackwater's activities are not the government's activities, so that you can sort of distance yourself from them optically. But, you know, my argument, I think, is that that's not actually very useful for public policymaking or for the way that the public understands these systems. And the other thing is it sort of allows you to go back to the very foundation of these structures. So, you know, I was a classical musician before I went to law school. And if you're studying to be a world-level pianist or something, and you go to a new sort of top-level teacher after being a sort of prodigy in a small town or something, often what happens in those situations is they break your technique down to its most basic elements and rebuild you. And at that time, it feels very destructive and violent. You sort of feel like you're an infant again for a while. But the reason they do that is because you may have learnt some bad techniques along the way that need to sort of be excised before you can build the strongest foundation possible, which usually these sort of world-class teachers have. And so when we have an existing financial system that in many ways is the product of generations of historical sediment, legal and political and technical, what new forms of disruptive technology allow us to do is to sort of break all of that down and rebuild it again without the weight of that history being the dominant guiding light. The last thing that it can do, and this is actually, I would say, something slightly technically new, so maybe I'm sort of going against what I said earlier, is that it can separate out different functions that until now, for sort of technical reasons, were very hard to separate out. So if you imagine the 1850s, or 1860s is perhaps a better example, and you have a bunch of national banks around the US, with very limited digital technology at that point, or electricity. And all of these banks are doing various forms of payment processing. Now, even if these national banks are sort of extending the full faith and credit of the government because their banknotes are backed by government securities or something, it would still be a lot more difficult for each of those banks to sort of call up the mint in Washington, D.C. and get them to send out coins or government paper notes every time they make a new loan. In that context, unless you wanted to sort of deputize every single bank to be its own mint, it would be technically difficult to collapse the banking payments layer with the sort of public payments layer, just because it's physically a long way away. And that is something that digital technology has the potential to allow us to revisit. So actually, if you go to the sort of common law of bank deposits, it goes back to the 1300s or 1400s. Benjamin Gaver has got a great chapter in the huge tome Money in the Western Legal Tradition by Wolfgang Ernst and David Fox on this topic. The law of deposits emerged because of the technical challenges with carrying large bags of gold on behalf of account holders, essentially. These gold money changers or goldsmiths kind of would have different people's bags of gold that they would take on a horse and cart or something, and it was very difficult to keep track of them all. It was a lot easier technically at that point simply to have a general claim against the goldsmith or the money transmitter and then let them pull all of those various funds into a single pot and carry that pot around. If you did really care about your money, if it was sort of sentimentally valuable or it was a certain kind of Spanish doubloon or something you wanted to keep, you would seal the bag, and the sealed bags would be kept separate from the general funds that were being transported. And that was actually a point of divergence in the law. On one hand, the common funds became the law of deposits. Anyone that gave money to that money transmitter had a general contractual claim against them. If you had a sealed bag, you owned the stuff in the sealed bag. That was the law of bailment or the law of debt in you. Now, today, the law of bailment or debt in you plays a very small role in most financial intermediation. It's primarily the law of deposits. But with a form of digital cash technology, you could have an intermediary, as I was saying before, sort of essentially managing your wallet for you, or managing a safety deposit box kind of equivalent for you. And it would be possible to resume or to sort of return to that other legal tradition of bailment, where the individual retains ownership over the funds, even as there is an intermediary managing their wallet. And that allows us to separate out the payments processing aspects of banking from the credit creation, from the credit extension aspects. And it's not that couldn't have been done beforehand in an analog world, but it becomes exponentially easier and more viable with the technology we have, or that we're developing today.
So to those ends, it's interesting. We neo-chartalists typically insist upon money's fundamentally centralized and public character in order to put pressure on hegemonic views that see money as a form of decentralized exchange. But importantly, and sort of what you've been alluding to with your last comments, you stress that monetary design should always provision certain forms of relatively decentralized or even private money use. Can you explain why this is politically and socially important and how it might work in terms of the digital technology that you're describing?
Yeah, sure. And I just want to start with a sort of caveat or note here. I think one reason this is a challenging topic, or it sounds a bit counterintuitive from a kind of left point of view that I do talk about these things, is because a lot of leftists, myself included, are not necessarily naturally kind of technologically adept or technologically inclined. We criticize surveillance state politics and organize anti-corporate campaigns from platforms on Twitter and Facebook and Gmail. Not because we necessarily think that's good praxis, but because the technological hurdle of switching to other more free or sort of, you know, politically consistent forms of technology that align with our values is difficult, unless you're sort of, you know, a coder or a programmer or something. So we're kind of predisposed to downplay the risks and the scope of technological politics. I think this is sort of the way that kind of Boots Riley talked about his recent movie, Sorry to Bother You. When you feel paralyzed by the inability to act, it's easier just to pretend the problem isn't as bad as it is, and to sort of just sort of learn to accept the problem as inevitable. And for a while, I was one of those people. If I'm not doing anything wrong, you know, why do I care? You know, surely the best that we can do is to sort of just trust in these government systems to do the best job for us. If everything's going to go to hell in a handbasket, you know, there's nothing I can do about it. There's nothing perhaps we can all do about it other than kind of just try as hard as we can. But a law professor of mine at Columbia, Eben Moglen, who is a sort of long-time technology and privacy advocate, he was on the record, he stuck it for me. He said, privacy isn't an individual thing or a private thing. It's a public ecological issue. It doesn't matter if you don't give your social security number out to anybody. If they have every other person who was born in Boston in that year, you're just the other person left. You know, you're the other guy. So every time you send an email via Gmail, you're not only placing yourself under surveillance, you're placing everyone you send that email to under surveillance. So you can't really leave privacy to a matter of kind of individual kind of neoliberal kind of, you know, as a politics of the self. It really needs to be considered as a social and public phenomenon. The other thing that he said, two other things that stuck with me. One was that the way that historically, he's a legal historian, by the way, the way that totalitarian regimes and empires have typically fallen is that the empire or the regime overexerts itself, either materially in its sort of attempts to control the populace or socially in that, or ideologically, sorry, and that sort of eventually the people on the wall, you know, they refuse to shoot the protesters or the people going over the wall. But in a world of perfect technological surveillance and of kind of data mined dreams where the government knows you're a political risk before you might know you're going to be a political risk because of the way that you were browsing certain websites or the way that your learning profile at the age of 5 matches the learning profile of other radicals or something. The cost of total surveillance and control drops dramatically. And then when you have drones who kind of won't hesitate to shoot anyone who comes over the wall, they don't have a conscience, suddenly the kind of biological or kind of social circuit breakers against persistent totalitarianism don't work as well anymore. So the last line he said to me that really kind of got me was just, you know, he was a Holocaust survivors, and he said, next time they come for, you know, my family of Jews in Eastern Europe, they're going to get every single one, because they've got a list now of everybody knows, and where they are at all times, because they're carrying a little computer in their pocket that sends a GPS signal directly to a central database that they can monitor and track. So that's kind of when the gravity of the kind of privacy issue hit me. And then when I walked into these debates about cash, you had people like Ken Rogoff, who, when he was, you know, not busy making spreadsheet errors that, you know, justified austerity for a generation, is writing books called The Curse of Cash, because he says it facilitates crime, and most importantly for him, it makes it hard for central bankers to maintain the myth that monetary policy and interest rates can manage the entire economy on their own without, you know, any fiscal intervention. The classic monetary theory of the zero lower bound is that you can't drop interest rates below zero or too much below zero, because everyone will just move their money into cash and store it under their mattress. Now, if we could get rid of cash, he dreams, salivates, then we could have negative interest rates, which would stimulate investment, and we'll never have a situation where we need to rely on fiscal policy because interest rate, you know, management has run out. I've written on that in a paper called "Do Negative Interest Rates Live Up to the Hype?" I think it's actually incoherent on its own front. But either way, these central bankers who are desperate to preserve the relevance of themselves are willing to throw anonymous cash under the bus in that process. And what we're seeing is these central bankers behind closed doors are having debates about whether we really need privacy or anonymity in cash at all, and are sort of mostly concluding that we don't. The Bank of Sweden is one of the few exceptions on that front. But as I said, these are not people who are trained in civil liberties or legal, you know, or political science. These are people who got degrees in mostly mathematical modeling. They, you know, to use their own favorite line, they're just not technically qualified to comment on the privacy implications of what they're talking about. And so I think it's really important that people who do care about these issues, you know, and we're talking about, on one hand, you know, Sarah Jeong has talked about the idea of sort of, you know, financial transactions as a form of free speech or a form of expression, political expression, because, you know, we're leftist enough or materialist enough that we acknowledge that, you know, ideas have to have a material form in some way. And so, you know, campaign donations and other things, you can't organize politically without resources. And if all resource transfers require the approval of a central regulator, then it's going to be very hard to do things that are potentially quite disruptive to that regulator. You know, one person's anti-terrorist law is another person's anti-freedom fighter law. And, you know, in addition to sort of political action, you also have things like socially stigmatized activities. So, you know, the war on drugs or sex work criminalization, or even, you know, fascist things like the Trump administration under Chris Kobach proposing to, quote-unquote, fund the Trump's wall by taxing cross-border remittances of immigrant workers from Mexico who are coming up to, you know, work on the farms and things to use control over those cross-border payments networks to potentially disrupt what is currently, I think, about a $17 billion industry, which would be more than enough to pay for a chunk of the wall, or at least to force Mexico to come to the negotiating table on that. So transactional freedom has a lot of different dimensions of political freedom, you know, inherent or intertwined with it. And it's not the same as sort of being a kind of right-wing free speech advocate, or sort of saying we should allow corporations to funnel millions of dollars in dark money to political candidates, or to have people create, you know, dummy corporations in the Cayman Islands or something. You know, there are going to be crude thinkers who are going to conflate those two different conceptions of sort of monetary privacy as a form of speech privacy, as a form of political privacy. But in my view, they're fundamentally different, and it's important that the left doesn't abandon that issue to the right wing. In terms of how I see this working technologically, I'm not a kind of infosec guy, but the way that I think of this is a metaphor is rather than transacting with other people digitally, rather than sort of having an account where my money flows from my account to your account, what we're creating is a kind of common wallet network layer or protocol, kind of like the TCP/IP protocol of the internet, or the email protocol or something. And every time you and I want to transact, we sort of take our wallet that has the equivalent of like a digital version of a paper note, where however much our wallet has just has that number written in the corner of that note. So, you know, I've got a digital note worth $87.50, and you've got one worth $45 or something. And when we want to transact, we go to the wallet network and we say, I'd like you to rip up my note and rip up this other note and then give us two other notes back that are worth the same amount overall but have different relative values. What I mean by that is if I have $50 and you have you know, $10 and I want to give you $20, so we both have $30, it would be like we both go up in balaclavas to a robot and we say to that robot, destroy this $50 note, destroy this $10 note, give us back two $30 notes. The robot doesn't need to know who we are, doesn't need to know you know, which one of us is giving the $50 and the $10. It doesn't even actually need to know that it's 50 and 10 going into 30 and 30. Technically speaking, all it needs to know is that 50 plus 10 on one side equals 30 plus 30 on the other. If you imagine sort of an envelope and it can weigh the two envelopes in its hand, as long as the two weigh the same amount, it doesn't actually need to know how much is in them. It just needs to know that they weigh exactly the same amount. So technically speaking, what you're looking for here is a way for monetary transactions to take place between two entities where the transactional network is ensuring there's no counterfeiting, there's no double spending, there's no, you know, someone taking the same $10 bill and spending it in two places at once. But beyond that, the only people who know anything about the transaction are the two people transacting themselves. And that is, to me, the essence of what physical cash allows us to do today. The government still can control how much cash is out there, can still control, you can still, you know, see what barcodes are on the notes when you try to deposit them at a bank or use them to pay taxes or something. But if you and I both happen to have some cash and we want to meet somewhere in a public square, and we're wearing a balaclava because it hasn't been criminalized yet in that state, we can go do that and make a transaction where we sort of, you know, like people do in the fish markets, you know, or the sushi markets or something, where they transact with these long robes so that they put their hands into each other's robes so that nobody can see exactly how much is transacting, so that nobody else knows the prices people are paying. You could do that kind of anonymized transaction, technically. That's the political goal that I'm working towards as a matter of sort of privacy and economic freedom. Let the dollar circulate. Let the dollar circulate. Interest rates going up. Seems like no value in the book. Meat prices up to stay. Utilities are on their way. Airlines are running late. Please let the dollar circulate. Let it circulate, 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 circulate.
I think what's so brilliant about what you've done is you've taken the previously kind of calcified relations of how people see abstract mediation or governance, so like Kafka or even Foucault, where there's a potential for the medium of itself to be viewed as inherently totalitarian, right? As inherently abridging freedoms of the actors who participate in its shadow. And what you've done is you've kind of proved and shown how one could design a system that's inherently abstract and mediates abstractly, but still preserves the freedom and privacy that formerly could be only seen to be happening in supposed real or immediate interactions.
Yeah, and I think the critical thing to note here, and this is why I'm involved in the MNT project more generally, is that this only works if you have an underlying theory of the public nature of money itself. Right, we're talking about cash as an instrument, but that doesn't work unless there is actually cash circulating in the economy at a reasonable amount that people can have access to. So this is a sort of quote-unquote microeconomic, dare I say that word, kind of issue, in the sense that it isn't presupposing one way or the other how the money gets injected into the system, whose hands it ends up in, how much, you know, it starts off in those hands, what can be used to purchase, etc. Those are questions of politics and of socialization. This is just pointing out that at the point at which we have that foundation, transactional privacy is of itself a political and social good. And I think this is something that, again, there are certain leftists who romanticize a sort of pre-industrial or pre-developed complex civilizational view of kind of small towns or hunter-gatherer societies where everything is based on kin relationships or based on, you know, personal relationships as the kind of vision of the future of sort of optimal social interaction. And my view on that is probably influenced by being a city kid. I think that's quite oppressive in many ways. You know, if you're a weird, queer, or alternative kid in a small town, and everybody knows your shit all the time, that's extremely unpleasant. And for those kinds of people, the big city, however, you know, grinding and crushing it is from a kind of industrial point of view, from an identity point of view, is extremely liberating. That anonymity, that ability to walk outside and blend into a crowd, has a protective aspect to it, both from the local cop or the local lynch mob, but also from your own family. You know, there's a reason why in the US people go to college to find themselves. We don't do that in Australia, and dare I say it, I don't know how many people find themselves as much in Australia as a result of that. So yeah, I think that's exactly right, and it's critical to sort of keep both layers in your head at the same time, even if they may feel like they're in tension between the sort of inherently political nature of money and that kind of inherently abstract way that it gets used in certain individualized interactions.
Will you spell out for our listeners then the difference between this anonymous e-cash that's connected to a digital fiat currency and the vision of the future that is being spelled out by crypto enthusiasts and Bitcoin lovers?
Yeah, right. Definitely. This is a critical point. And to be clear, I have a lot of respect for a lot of the motivations of people who are in that space. Not all of them, obviously. But a lot of people are there because they care about privacy, because they're fundamentally anti-totalitarian and anti-fascist. I think a lot of them are victims of bad economics education or simply are not yet sufficiently monetarily informed to realize that in many ways they're barking up the wrong tree, because I think, you know, the legal view that I have is that economies and markets are ultimately legally constructed down to the base. You know, you have to own property to sell it. You have to be able to have contracts that can be enforced for transactions to have some sort of enduring stability, and in that sense, you know, the alternative to a government is a mafia that enforces black market transactions or a criminal, you know, set of gangs and things, which is just another way of saying a government with slightly less accountability. And so people who are trying to imagine money without the state, to me, that's sort of like trying to imagine law without a form of public authority. It's a sort of misnomer to me. So on one hand, some of the technology that comes out of those attempts can be very useful and really adoptable in other public contexts that is valuable. But my argument would be that it's actually public cash backed by a democratic macroeconomic vision that is the best way to preserve individual liberties, rather than trying to sidestep the state entirely on the money layer, even as you're ultimately going to rely on the state to keep the property titles of the goods that you want to trade. You know, there could be some anarchists and, you know, ANCAPs out there in the Bitcoin space that would love a world where they hire a private army to defend their wallet from a house robber or something. But I think most people who think that we could have a quote-unquote non-governmental money as the dominant monetary regime do so without fully thinking about how the government's still going to be all up in the rest of economic and commercial regulation anyway. And, you know, the MMT analysis that looks at money as public money as starting as a tax credit, and that looks at forms of private money as contractual relationships, you know, those things are inherently also tied to the enforcement of private commercial behavior. You know, if you have a contractual dispute and a judge issues an order of damages, that's a form of debt. That's a form of kind of almost like an individualized tax. And I've said elsewhere that the story of sort of taxes driving the value of public money that MMT talks about, you don't even need a head tax or a land tax or something. You could even do it with just the threat of legal sanction. You know, you walk down the street or drive down the street, and there's a risk that you hit someone with your car, and if you do so, they'll sue you, and you'll have to pay them money. And whatever the court says you have to pay that person in gains a sort of public moneyness, whatever the legal tender is for the settlement of that dispute. So I don't think you can have an economy that isn't grounded in public law, and as a result of that, I don't think you can have a money that serves the functions that the public monetary system does today that isn't grounded in public law. And because a lot of these private actors don't see that, they start from the wrong foundation, and they end up not getting to where they think they're going to get, which is why you see sort of things like Mt. Gox, you know, ultimately go under and have all these legal disputes, or the famous case that the DAO, the Decentralized Administrative Organization, that ended up suffering huge amounts of fraud and getting embroiled in legal conflicts and things. Mervyn King had a great line, the former Bank of England governor, that banks are global in life and national in death, which is a way of saying, you know, when the times are going good, cowboys like to think that they don't need anybody else. And when the shit hits the fan, suddenly they're in need of a community again. So I'm not really interested in sort of being a cowboy when it comes to this design stuff. I'm interested in starting from the community framework and moving from there.
So it seems like there are a lot of potential futures of money running in parallel to each other. Wanted to ask you as we close up here, what do you think it's going to take to realize the kind of transformation you are envisioning, the future of money that you've got in mind? And could you tell us a little bit about what are the obstacles as you see them, and what we can and should be doing to overcome them? And maybe even finally, you know, what can humanities scholars do to help?
Yeah, I mean, I guess global revolution is probably where I'd start.
Yeah. How's next week for you?
I mean, I'm sort of being mildly facetious, but not really. I mean, the work that I do with the ITU right now is in part a defensive stopguard, in the sense that there's no way in hell that the Chinese Communist Party or even the NSA is going to take the recommendations of the UN as the end point of their own geopolitical decisions about how surveilled their currency should be. Other countries may, Sweden may, Canada may even, but certainly not the sort of imperial powers are going to be considering that. That said, the technical standards, in the same way if we think about sort of the TCIP standards of the internet, if the technical standards can be kept open, that is to say, if the technical standards are a form of, allow for a form of anonymous digital cash, and we build this sort of global technical layer that is harmonized across different countries, even if the way that the Chinese Communist Party or the US government chooses to manifest that in their own jurisdiction is by adding a sort of surveilled layer on top, as long as that underlying kernel or structure is able to be open, then there's at least the possibility of it being undone in the future, or the global infrastructure not being poisoned with the poison of those interests. So I don't think that, you know, the UN is the space at which that political fight is going to be won. I think it might be the space at which we can keep that fight alive. I think this fight is only going to be won when social movements and you know, leftists around the world and others who care about freedom and anti-totalitarian concerns and economic justice and distributional and equity issues work together to put political pressure and bring attention to these issues. And they're going to be hard. It's not going to be easy. I mean, someone like Brett Scott, a friend of mine who's written on the war on cash, you know, he's shouting the alarm as well as anyone could. He's an excellent communicator and things. But it's a hard one to bring people's attention to. So we need to make sure that leftists, as they're building their sort of programs and their vision of the future, that they have this as a layer and a concern. And that means connecting the economic justice folks with the technological justice folks, and it means with, you know, thinking about empire at the same time as we think about domestic justice and thinking about, you know, technical and legal standards and design at the same time as we think about sort of red blood politics and distributional questions. And it also means, you know, not being blasé about the scope of this challenge. It's worth remembering that in the 1990s, public key encryption software, which is a, you know, complicated mathematical way of, you know, creating sort of these large prime numbers as a result of these large numbers as a result of the multiplication of two other prime numbers that allow, that's hard to sort of break cryptographically, and forms the basis of a lot of secure communications on the internet, was considered a form of military munitions. And the first person who shared an open source version of public key encryption software was charged with violating the Arms Export Control Act, a guy called Phil Zimmerman. And so, you know, I have some sympathy for, you know, people who claim that, you know, Satoshi Nakamoto is staying offline because he had, you know, he could have really pissed off some governments by starting this whole debate, or by kicking it up a notch. And if we're going to get close to something that's really meaningfully challenging the sort of total surveillance vision of both the NSA and the Chinese Communist Party, it's going to piss some really powerful people off, and we need to be ready for that fight, and we need to have all of our allies, you know, ready to support us in that fight. I think academics can try to bring attention to this issue and to make sure that they don't downplay it or consider it someone else's problem. You know, this was sort of what my professor at law school really beat into my head, was that this isn't someone else's problem. This isn't something I have a right to dismiss simply because I'm not technologically sophisticated enough yet to really understand the whole thing. This is a matter of good praxis and good research, as they say, is, you know, everything else. And everything else that, you know, when it comes to understanding and learning, you know, our responsibilities as politically informed and engaged people. So
what about culture and aesthetics and the kinds of things that we like to think about in the humanities? How does that figure into these questions you're raising about the future of digital money?
Yeah, great question. I mean, so I think one person whose ideas have influenced me a lot in recent years, in addition to sort of MMTers and other lawyers, is Viviana Zelizer, sociologist at Princeton, who wrote a book a few decades back now called The Social Meaning of Money. And so she talked about the way that people experience and use money independent of its sort of cold, colorless, functional, economic, you know, purpose. And the way that they attach meaning to economic transactions in sort of social ways. So if you think of kind of the red envelopes people send in China of cash as gifts, or the way that people, you know, like mafioso people don't like to put their criminal earned money in the collection plate when they go to church on Saturday and things, even though it doesn't really make a difference whether you use the money that somebody gave you for your wedding to buy a gift, or you use that to, you know, buy groceries and then use other money to buy the gift. There's still something about the act or the sort of symbolism of the money that people gave you at that moment. So we attach social meaning to economic transactions, I think, you know, because we're social creatures and we like to make meaning in otherwise day-to-day activities, you know, communal feasts and tea ceremonies and things. And I think this is intrinsic to the history of money. Alice Semenova and Michael Hudson, sort of MMT related monetary historians, have talked about the origins of money in Greece and Near Eastern civilizations, you know, in religious rituals and activities of temples and priests. So there's a sort of ritualistic aspect even to the sort of political nature of money. And you can see that today with the key signing ceremonies for various forms of cryptocurrency like Zcash, or people who identify on Reddit and Twitter as hodlers, you know, people holding crypto assets, HODL, and the cultures, the competing cultures that are built up around Bitcoin and Ether and Bitcoin Cash, or even, you know, Dogecoin or something. And so I think it's important to think about the aesthetic experience of using money when trying to change or influence social dynamics of money writ large. You know, Bitcoin in part was successful because it's a cool word. It was a cool concept. It was made cool. Even Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Sanders and Corbyn made sort of socialism cool again in a way. And that sort of, in part, obviously, there's underlying structural reasons why people were primed to hear those ideas. But it matters whether you're kind of the white-haired grumpy grandfather or the kind of young, cool-looking person from New York to the way that that message gets received. And I think the Ecuadorians in particular, who were some of the more far-sighted policymakers in this space, learned this lesson the hard way. They introduced a government mobile phone-based central bank currency in 2014, but they limited it only to sort of a certain narrow range of government transactions with a pretty unsexy government-developed mobile phone app. And it didn't really spark the imagination or engender trust, and it didn't really generate a particularly growing usage, and it was ultimately cancelled and is now sort of considered a failure case, tragically. By contrast, one of the groups that the e-currency team that I've been consulting with works with in the Philippines is a commercial bank that's working under one of these regulatory sandboxes with the Central Bank of the Philippines, realized early on that they weren't going to get widespread adoption of this digital currency technology unless they built a whole ecology. And so they've got marketplaces and merchants involved from day one. They had this big kickoff event where they had everybody wearing t-shirts and sort of made a whole festival day where people could come and sort of go to a kind of marketplace and buy and sell things. They put these promotional videos out, etc. And it's sort of a bit hokey and a bit marketing kind of gimmicky, but I think that's ultimately part of the way that we need to think about this. And of course, the private sector guys know this intrinsically because half of them are snake oil salesmen. And if you're a snake oil salesman, the one thing you go to do is make sure your snake oil is better than everyone else's, or at least looks better than everyone else's. So I think we need to think about the aesthetics of the experience, as well as just the functional improvements that we're offering. In addition to that, we need to have new stories and new cultures to fit this new monetary paradigm. I mean, if you think about the early cypherpunks who were working on those anonymous cash ideas as well as other forms of cryptography in the 80s and 90s, they had their own movies, their own books, they had their own chat rooms and things. And I think that really gave them a sense of communal identity and a set of cultural reference that facilitated their educational and political journeys and sort of served as heuristics in many ways or artifacts that sort of carry significant depth of meaning in ways that sort of just being explicit wouldn't. Just to give an example of that, my partner is part of this Facebook group called NumTots, New Urbanist Memes for Transit-Oriented Teens, which sort of started as this joke group and now has about 100,000 members around the world, of people who are sort of enthusiastic about public transport. And they have this sort of set of memes and inside jokes and sort of implicit expectations, understandings around the way that they talk and think about public transportation. And she was already an enthusiast, which is why she joined the group. But I think it's fair to say that space and that aesthetic and cultural experience really has sort of further radicalized her and made her feel part of something bigger, that wouldn't have happened simply from logic and just having strong sort of political values. I think the last element here is probably that we're in a world driven by attention scarcity. There's so many sources of stimulus and information out there. There's so many multiple competing serious political challenges and economic and social kind of pathways that we can choose. Part of the challenge is working out where to put our attention. And that requires building a culture that brings in the kind of people that we want and need and educates them and respects their time and respects their, the rest of their life and sort of fits in with it rather than asks them to change. And I think media and culture, particularly viral and mass media, has the potential to capture the public imagination at this moment and drive public debate and set the terms of the agenda in ways that dry, technical statements or even sort of political statements directly don't. And this is, again, Boots Riley recently, I think, has probably done a better job, but sorry to bother you, in educating a whole segment of the population about labor struggles and union militancy than sort of 1,000 Marxist reading group sessions would have done. And it's sort of brilliant art in that sense. on the dark side, I think Trump was pretty successful in dominating the national stage and sort of captivating the media in a sort of train wreck style. He was transfixing in a kind of brutal and violent way, you know, as he acted a kind of real life version of his fake real life persona on The Apprentice, in DC rather than in a New York studio. But it was this sort of real life, you know, fake life, real life kind of version of a larger than life person that was so effective and enabled him to develop a huge following with very little payment of his own media, of his own media spending in the campaign. And I think, you know, on the other side of the fence, art that reifies existing myths and retrograde understandings about money can and should serve as a side of, you know, critique and contestation, which, you know, I think you all have been doing excellently, and I'm so excited about MMN HD as a project. And obviously money, and particularly digital money, or maybe less so digital money actually, is a sort of drier topic than some other political topics like, you know, racism or sexism or other things. We should be trying to problematize and deconstruct portrayals of money in popular culture and in sort of, you know, artistic artifacts and things, in the same way as we deconstruct other problematic, you know, representations. I remember some pretty good analysis, for example, of how the Dark Knight trilogy was a fascist trilogy, and, you know, other more basic examples. I think like the Bechdel test have done a good job sort of bringing to light the sort of subconscious, you know, oppression inherent in the way that we tell certain kinds of stories in media. And Max's, you know, analysis of Inglourious Basterds, I think, is a sort of paradigmatic example of how we can be moving that sort of effort ahead. But in order to do that, we definitely need a kind of clear picture of what the political and legal and technical issues are when it comes to money, and what we actually mean and what we want when we talk about, you know, economic and monetary freedom and justice in the digital age. So that requires that deeper kind of technical, technological, political, ideological education, as well as sort of merely artistic and cultural critique.
We're on great. This has been incredibly enlightening. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Thanks, Ron. Thank you.